Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hello, Diane.
How are ya?
I'm fabulous. Happy Passover, Easter, and whatever else we have going this week.
Yes, indeed. Happy Passover and happy Easter to all those who celebrate. What kind of a week did you have?
A fabulous week. It only snowed once.
You're right. And I think the day before it was 70?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yep.
You know, this is Cleveland. If you don't like the weather, wait a minute. All right. So things often work out differently from the way we think they will. And this week is no exception. Originally, our show this week was going to offer up three different views of the Handmade show. Instead, we've morphed the show into two longer interviews with two incredibly fascinating guests. First, we're going to run on out to Santa Cruz, California. And we're going to speak with Paul Sadoff from Rock Lobster Cycles. We spoke with Paul about his work back in February of 2012, and what prompted me to ask him back to the show for this topic was his commentary on why and how the North American Handmade Bicycle Show is changing, and whether those changes are good, bad, or something else altogether. In response to a show report in Bicycle Times magazine, Paul had this to say, quote, "Some builders are too busy to exhibit at the show. In spite of how great and unique the hand-built show is, the builders with long lists of orders opted to stay home and keep the customers happy," end quote. We'll ask him to expand on this thread and give us his perspective on the custom business today. He's also going to talk about a new collaboration between himself and the venerable Bruce Gordon. It's going to be good. After a break and some news, yes, we do have news this week. We're going to head down to Greensboro, Alabama, to speak with Pam Dorr. I thought we were going to talk about a bike that was stolen from the North American Handmade Bicycle Show in Charlotte and then was recovered, as well as the company that made that bike. But that is such a tiny part of this amazing woman's story. Pam Dorr started out as a designer for Victoria's Secret in San Francisco. She rode into Greensboro, Alabama in 2003 and never looked back. She turned parts of Greensboro from a poor and dying downtown into a thriving community, creating 11 new businesses, including a bamboo bike manufacturing facility, 50 new jobs, and the transformation has garnered $26 million in profits. Since 2006. I'd say she embodies the word entrepreneur in spades.
She has it all covered.
She does have it all covered. So let's head off to Santa Cruz, California for a juicy conversation with Rock Lobster's Paul Sadoff. Paul, thanks for joining us on the show this week.
It's good to be back.
Yeah, what's going on in California, in Santa Cruz?
Well, we have some really banner weather here. Just did a Grand Fondo Sunday.
Nice.
With my wife. It was the first one she's ever done, and she still doesn't hate me, so that's good.
Yeah. What was the distance?
Well, it was only 40 miles, but it had about a 2,100-foot climb up to the top of Howell Mountain, and there's some steep parts, but she soldiered on. She hasn't really been doing much riding for the last maybe 4 or 5 years, and so she trained for about 6 weeks, and we did it, and just perfect banner, beautiful day, and it's good. I've needed to get away because I'm looking at my dry erase board, and there's about 42 frames on there that I have to build.
Holy smokes. Well, I guess that answers one of the last questions I had for you, like how is business? But we'll get to that. I want to talk to you about your views on the Handmade show, how the custom bike builder is doing these days. So there was an article in Bicycle Times that evoked a comment from you. You said some builders are too busy to exhibit at the show, and in spite of how great and unique the hand-built show is, the builders with long lists of orders opted to stay home and keep the customers happy. So The show is changing, and you also said that the Bicycle Times article missed a trend. So tell me a little bit about your thinking on that line.
What I notice at these shows, and I've had, you know, I've kind of battled myself with this, is I want to exhibit at these shows because they are the best place for a custom bike builder to be, because you're around all your peers and there's great stuff there, and that's where all, you know, the international press shows up generally, and you get a lot of publicity, and some people even got orders. I've gotten orders at those shows, not many, but you know, It's a great thing. But I noticed that there's a couple different builders there. Well, I mean, there's more than a couple, but there's a pretty big dividing line between the guys who do it for a living and the guys that are, what I say, enthusiasts. And the enthusiasts have the time and ability to make stuff that's just incredible. I mean, just rolling works of art. But the problem with these things is the amount of hours that they put into making them makes them pretty much impossible to earn a living building or even earn like a paltry wage, and it's sad. And I used to be one of those guys trying to make the fanciest, most beautiful bike and spending 200 hours on a frame and then realizing, wow, if I sold this for what frames go these days, I'd be making about $1.50 an hour. And so there's those guys who are like enthusiast hobbyists, but still highly, highly, highly skilled. I mean, making just incredible stuff. And then there's the rest of those guys who we put food on the table. The prices of our frames are usually a lot less because it takes us less time to build them. And we build for people who are not necessarily collectors or looking for a rolling work of art. They're looking for a bike that fits them, that they can use for a really long time, that just feels like home, that was built here in America by somebody who they get to talk to. And, I mean, there's something to be said about that. And so I'm finding that more and more guys like me are not doing the show because they get too busy with orders. I am way too busy to do any show, even the hand-built show. Also, for a one-person shop like me, I would have to fork over $3,000 or $4,000 to do this show. Not necessarily for the booth. The booth is probably, I don't know, $1,000 or something like that. $1,100, I'm not really sure what they are now. I haven't done a show for a couple years. But I have to ship all my stuff across the country to exhibit. And then, of course, a hotel or hit up somebody I know out there and to stay with. And then there's probably renting a car or whatever you need to do. And it winds up being a lot of money and being away from home and being away from my wife and also delaying bicycles, frames. So in the time that would take me to do a show, which is a one solid week of being away from here, I could build comfortably 3 to 4 bicycle frames for people. Some of them have been waiting 7 months. And so for me, the show is going to make my customers wait longer, and it's also going to cost me a bunch of money that I don't have a heck of a lot of. And then I think about, where would I want to spend that $3,000 or $4,000? Do I want to spend it going to a bike show, which would actually delay my progress of satisfying my customers, or would I take a vacation instead?
Well, you know? And that's a good point. People don't realize the amount of time and effort on your level that goes in, let alone on the, you know, what you call the real artisan who's making, you know, 2 or 3 frames a year and their works of art. Do you think that the regional shows that are sort of being spawned from the big handmade show, is that a reason for that? That some of these builders, some of the original 6 or the original 10 or the original 20 have begun to opt out because not only the expense and the time, but their boards are filled, as you say. Is that giving somebody else an opportunity, these regional shows?
Well, I think the regional shows are just trying to be different than the hand-built show. They see the success of the hand-built show, but they see flaws within it, which I can't really go into. But, you know, nothing is perfect. Putting on that show must be monumentally difficult. And so I think these other shows are cropping up in areas where there's a fair amount of bike builders who don't necessarily want to travel and also want a different vibe at their show. Like the San Diego show I used to do was put on by a number of people, including Brian Bayless, who's a very, very, very notable award-winning hand-built show alumnus. I mean, his stuff was arguably some of the best that anybody had ever seen. Really amazing stuff. And he opted to do a show in his hometown and charge quite a bit less for booths, cater the event for the builders, and allow people to ride bikes. It was really, really, really different show.
I was there.
Yeah, unfortunately, it wasn't. It really wasn't all that successful, though.
No, it wasn't.
It was. I think that San Diego might be a relatively apathetic community when it comes to stuff like that, and also I don't think that they had the ability to promote it the way they should have. And so, but yeah, that was a show where a number of Southern California builders thought, hey, we can do something that is maybe a little bit lower key, cost a heck of a lot less, and a little more friendly to the builders in terms of, well, when you load in, hey, there's a table with a whole bunch of pizza and beer and stuff on it while you're loading in.
Right.
I mean, how nice is that?
Yeah.
You know, when you go to the hand-built show, it's just a load-in, you know?
I got it. I totally understand. I'm speaking with Paul Sadoff. He is the owner of Rock Lobster Cycles out in Santa Cruz. And we're talking about the differences coming up with the handmade show, custom builders, and sort of what the trending is today. So what is trending these days in terms of, I saw a lot of the photographs from the hand-built show, and it seems there's a lot of cyclocross stuff going on. There's a lot of fat tire stuff going on. What's trending at Rock Lobster?
Well, I haven't really changed a whole heck of a lot in the last, whatever, 10 or 15 years in terms of what people want from me. However, there seems to be more in the way of disc brake cross bikes and disc brake road bikes on order.
Do you like it?
I don't know. Anything new is kind of exciting. I am much more open to it now than I was before. You know, say about 4 or 5 years ago, I thought, well, why would people want disc brakes on these bikes? But then, now I'm starting to think, well, why not?
Well, I can see it on cross. I still have a question about road and the strength of the forks and I don't know. Maybe.
If you have a rider who is 6'5" and 240, 250 pounds, I think disc brakes are a good idea. And those are some of the people ordering custom bikes.
That's true.
And they're not convinced that, especially if they ride in a rainy climate, you know, in the northern United States or whatever, that they're going to have adequate braking with caliper brakes.
That's true.
Because most of the groups that are made for bicycles are made for people who are more mid-sized. And I see some guys out there, even racing cyclocross, who are not, you know, real heavy people. They're just larger, you know. They're 6'1", 195 pounds. And they say, yeah, I really appreciate the stopping power of disc brakes, being able to wait longer before you get to a corner to apply the brakes. So, you know, less hand fatigue and stuff. And then, I don't know, there is a certain amount of, snobbery factor, like, oh, got to have the latest thing.
Well, there is that.
Disc brake bike with electric shifting and all that.
So that brings me to another question I have, and I wanted to ask you about what you see. Production bikes are just unbelievably expensive today. Where does that put custom builders relative to the bike shops? Who would buy a production bike right off of the rack when they could get a custom handmade bike that fits them absolutely perfectly from a custom builder? Why would somebody buy the production bike, and why are they so expensive?
Well, there's a lot of engineering and marketing and a huge hierarchy of people to pay, and a fair amount of waste, too, in what the big companies do. By waste, I mean not by and large wasteful companies. I mean, they're bicycle companies. They're, you know, trying to build bicycles, trying to do their best job of it. But when you have stuff made in China or Taiwan or whatever, and it's not your factory, there's a good chance that there's a certain percentage of stuff is just going to be defective. And the better companies take this stuff back and give people replacements.
Yes, that's
true. But what they do with all this old stuff is cut the frame in half, regardless of how fancy it is, or regardless of whether it can be fixed or not, and dispose of it. And so I believe that's a bunch of waste that custom frame builders don't have, because they can't afford it, you know. And also, I think it's easier for a custom frame builder to catch a production problem and deal with it. It's all right in front of us,
right,
in front of our faces, you know. You get a defective tube from your supplier and a bike breaks, well, then you inspect those tubes and replace them with something that doesn't break. Whereas somebody gets, some company gets, five containers of bikes from Taiwan, and there's a defect that they can't see, and then all those bikes go out on the road, and a number of them start breaking, and they recall all of them.
That is
And then
true.
They have to wait, you know, 3 to 4 months for their next batch
right.
that are not defective.
That's a very interesting point, one that I had never thought about before, the amount of defective bikes that are out there, because there are always recalls these days. You know, you can go to CPSC's website at any time and see recalls in the bicycle world.
That's part of what you're paying for.
True.
I think, you know, operating overhead is and profit also come into, say, a frame that is a good frame, you know, like a good molded carbon fiber frame from Taiwan. Why it will cost, you know, $1,900 in America, when in Taiwan it's a fraction of that. I mean, it's not like $50 or something like that. It's going to be maybe a few hundred dollars, but it's a few hundred dollars.
Right.
And it's decaled, it's painted, it's prepped, it's in a box, and it's on its way over here.
Right.
So why does it get marked up about 4 or 5 times?
Everybody gets paid along the way.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff that went into making that frame. The molds to make these frames cost, oh, I don't know, with all the labor and everything like that, pretty close to about, I think, $150,000,
$160,000. Yeah, but how many frames will come out of a mold, though?
Oh, thousands.
Yeah.
However, they have to have a number of molds to do all the different sizes.
True.
And then the fashions change, and so they have to make a new mold to make a compact frame or a level top tube frame or a frame for the new bottom bracket standard or the new head tube standard. You know, or they have different models. They have, like, your big tire road frame or your normal road racing frame or your time trial frame. Say a company like Specialized, you look at their catalog, just carbon bikes alone, it's staggering how many bikes they have to build.
It is. It absolutely is.
Yeah, I mean, a company's a behemoth. I mean, it takes a lot to keep that company rolling and also keep the top people in their top salaries. So,
all right, I have one more topic.
And
Schnozola.
Hmm.
Go ahead. You got to tell us. You already promised to tell me that you have a collaboration going with our buddy Bruce Gordon. What is this?
Well, this is something I came up with, and I don't know where I was. I just thought about it, and I thought,
probably in the shower.
It's hard to say. You know, I really think that Bruce is probably one of the most notable builders in the history of American bike building.
I would agree.
And when I was 22 years old, before I built a bike frame, I got hired to work at a very nice high-end bike shop here in Santa Cruz. And the owner had me walk around the room and look at all the frames on display. And he imported a lot of frames. He had a lot from Europe and, you know, from Italy and France and Great Britain, you know, Hetchins and, you know, W.B. Herlow and some Belgian frames and some French frames. And then he had some American frames. He had a full wall of Eisentrout frames. And then there was this one Bruce Gordon frame. And it just was prettier and more beautifully put together than any frame in the shop, including the Eisentrouts, which were staggeringly beautiful, too. And it inspired me to try to build a bike frame. I thought, wow, this is the way it should be done. This thing's just incredible. It was also more expensive than any of the other frames, too. But I felt like, well, with this one, you're really getting what you pay for. And so I thought, it's been in the back of my mind, you know, for a long time. And I've become friends with Bruce over the years, and I buy tires from him. I've bought some handlebars and some fork blades and stuff. And we talk back and forth. And I thought, why wouldn't it be fun to do a bike with Bruce? And in terms of the amount of business, you know, Bruce's business, I mean, he's got some people coming in. He sells a few things here and there. But it's not like me. I'm not saying I'm doing it better. I'm just whatever. I'm the flavor of the month now. I have a tremendous amount of business. And I thought if there's any, it would be to try and get whatever excitement about that's happening with my bikes over to his bikes, which, I don't know, in my opinion, I think the stuff he does is just, it's light years ahead of what I've ever done, you know?
He is a very interesting man, and he has a very interesting eye for perfection.
Definitely.
So what did you come up with?
I came up with a bike that's a big tire road bike, but almost touring style, to take Bruce Gordon's 700x43 Rock and Road tires. But it's not exactly like the Bruce Gordon Rock and Road. We
okay.
both had ideas on geometry, but I wanted to bring Bruce a little bit more into the 21st century.
Well, and kicking and screaming, I'm sure.
Not this time.
Really?
Not this time. I said, how about a unicrown fork? He said, yeah. I said, how about disc brakes? He said, you really think so? I said, oh, yeah. You get those big wheels. You know, they have a lot of energy. It takes effort to stop them. If you have those disc brakes, and it's going to be easier to stop. And if it's a bike with a full touring load, then I think it would come in handy. So I thought, why not? You know, cable-actuated brakes, and we'll offer a couple different quality levels. One would be like a Shimano 105 or Shimano LX group. You could either go with a triple with bar end shifters, or you could do the STI, like a 105 level. That would be the one, the lower end, which I'd call the 2 cents plane.
Okay.
And then if you want the fancier buildup, which would be either Altegra or Dior XT Shimano, that would be brisket. You know, that's
oh
only
my
when,
God.
You know.
You guys
the...
are too funny. It's like listening to my father talk here. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so Schnozola, I mean, it's everybody likes a good deal. Everybody appreciates a good deal. So this will be a good deal. But for a made in America, you know, ground up, you know, made in Northern California by two guys whose combined experience is almost 80 years in the bike business.
Right.
And I don't know, something of this quality that's, I mean, there's bikes from Taiwan with the similar kind of equipment going for more. I thought, what a great thing to offer people.
So when might these be available, these Schnozolas?
Well, I'm building the first one right now.
Okay.
Well, I'm doing some of it, and then Bruce is doing the rest of it. I'm doing the mitering and the tacking, and then I'm bringing it up to his shop, and he wants me to weld it because I have many hundreds of bikes TIG welding experience where he, you know, he like does tacking and does the racks and stuff. He prefers not to do it.
Right.
And so I'll do the welding, and then he'll do all the brazons, and he's a very accomplished powder coater, so he's going to paint the frame. And then I will bring it back here and prep it and assemble it, I imagine.
And when will these first ones be available, perhaps?
Well, the first one's sold. And I think the second one's sold. So what I have to do is, it's available. I mean, if somebody wants one, we'll build one. It's just that we haven't done any publicity at all. You're one of maybe three people I've told so far.
Oh, this is awesome. Oh, I feel privileged. I feel really privileged. That's awesome. I love the name. I mean, it's just
awesome. This is pre-production, pre-product launch conversation we're having here.
Well, I think it's awesome. I think it's awesome. And I can't wait to see the first one. So maybe you'll send me a picture when you get it built?
Oh, yeah.
That would be awesome.
Bruce has arranged for a photographer to shoot lots of pictures while we're putting this thing together.
Oh, even better, a photo sort of essay. How nice.
Yeah, and our motto, Schnozola, because the air is free.
And did you come up with that or did Bruce?
I did.
Wow, you must be able to get right in his head.
I've made him laugh, and I consider that a great accomplishment. I think it's a good thing to make people laugh.
I do too, and good for you, because it's hard to get Bruce Gordon to laugh.
Yeah.
It is hard. Well, and this is much better than Swamptose. So Swamptose. Making a bike.
It has something to do with it a little bit.
I know it does. How could it not?
Well, Schnozola, I don't know.
Do you have a head badge? Do you have your design for your logo?
The first customer's name is Jeff Traugott, and he has one heck of a nose. And so we're probably going to use that. The profile of that nose is going to be part of the head tube decal. And then the down tube decal is going to have a very much of a Hebrew type font to it.
Okay.
And I have to put that together this week.
That is so funny. I love it. Maybe on that note, we should just end this conversation and let you get back to work. You have a gazillion frames to do. I really appreciate you taking time on your busy day to talk to me.
No, it's okay. No such thing as bad publicity.
That is true.
At least that's what Keith Richards says.
It is, and we have lots of wonderful listeners who are going to enjoy our conversation. So,
well, I hope they enjoy this because I enjoyed talking.
Well, and please say hi to Bruce for me. I haven't talked to him this year, but I'll catch up with him after the first schnozola rolls out of the door. How's that?
I will be seeing him Saturday, and okay. We are hopefully going to complete this Saturday.
Excellent. Well, just tell him Diane says hey.
I will do that.
All right, Paul. Have a great weekend.
Okay, you too.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay.
Bye.
Paul Sadoff joined us from his facility out in Santa Cruz, California. Paul is an interesting guy, and he also is going to produce this interesting bike with Bruce Gordon. I'm very excited about that project, this new schnozola bicycle. So we are going to take a quick break on the Outspoken Cyclist. We will then be back with news, and then we'll head on down to Alabama and talk with Pam Doerr.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
On April 27th at 3:30 p.m., the Cleveland Women's Orchestra returns for its spring anniversary concert, featuring prodigy soloist Gavin George as he performs Mendelssohn's Piano Concerto No. 1. This 79th annual performance takes place at historic Severance Hall in Cleveland's University Circle District. Tickets are available. More information at the Severance Hall box office, 216-231-1111, or online at severancehall.com.
While cutting molding with a 12-inch dual compound miter saw, while holding a newborn baby in your arms, when face-to-face with a congregation of alligators, with the ball in your hands and the entire freaking season on the line.
There are a million places you'd never consider texting, so why would you do it while driving? NASCAR driver Casey Kane here, asking you to please stop the text, and together we can stop the wrecks.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Get the message at stoptextstopwrecks.org.
We are back on the Outspoken Cyclist. I am Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
Well, Tim, this week we get to do some news. Do you have some news for us?
We have lots of news. But
yeah?
A quick update for those in Colorado. I see that AAA Roadside Assistance is now going to include bicycles.
That's cool.
And it will cover tandems also.
Tandems or bicycles?
Well, that's what they put in their press release, that they're covering tandems also. No increase in the fee. If you're already a member, it just goes ahead and it covers it naturally.
No kidding.
Yep. They're going to provide transportation service for members when their bicycles are disabled or inoperable. And this is effective May 1st, 2014.
So does that mean that they're not going to come out and fix your bike? They're only going to pick you up and hoof you back to some facility?
Well, what they're saying right now is they're going to provide transportation. So
okay.
I think in some cases that's a good start, and they may find that it's easier actually to provide a little assistance where they can actually fix it. But it's good to see the program start.
You know, it might be interesting that AAA think about hiring a small fleet of bicycle mechanics.
Yep, and they would be able to, well, maybe they could ride out and fix the bike instead of...
Oh, isn't that an interesting idea? Well, originally I had this news from VeloNewsCompetitor.com about Chris Horner, who was hit. Poor Chris. Does this guy not? I mean, if he didn't have bad luck, he'd have no luck at all, you know? At the time that this came out, he was in an Italian hospital with a punctured lung and fractured ribs, and police were searching for the hit-and-run driver, and they don't think he would be able to start at the Giro. Since then, he has been released from the hospital. Because right on the way to the studio, a new press release came in, and he was released from the hospital. However, he is still going to be possibly ready for the Tour, but not ready for the Giro. So it's sad. He's the oldest cyclist in the Peloton. He's 42 years old. And here he is getting smacked up by a car. This week is actually filled with that kind of bad news. So this is my sending you good vibes, Chris Horner, that you can ride again soon. I hope so. What else you got?
We have Chris Hoy, who is a six-time Olympic champion, is switching from two wheels to four wheels with the aim of racing in the 2016 Le Mans 24-hour sports car race.
Wow.
Nissan said on Tuesday that they would put the Scott, who's already a brand ambassador for Nissan, they're going to go ahead and put them in their driver development program. And Nissan has a very good program where they take people that don't race at all and add them into this. And so in 2015, he's going to race in a Nissan GT3 in a British championship. And then the goal is to go ahead and move him on to the 24-hour race in 2016. So it's really interesting to see. Obviously, fitness isn't going to be a problem for this.
Well, so that is a question I have. So if somebody is a bike racer and they're very, very fit, do you have to be really, really fit to be a car racer too?
Yes,
oh,
you do.
Okay. See, I don't know much about car racing.
A lot of it just has to do with the G-forces and all
well,
that
true.
Go with that. But also the fitness is important because of the temperature inside the car and the heat and all the other things that you have to do with it. Because racing now happens so quickly that you need to have reaction time and all the other stuff that goes with it. And I know Porsche and Audi with their programs work all winter long with fitness for their factory drivers. And cycling is certainly included in that as well as anything else that they can do for their fitness.
Well, it's cool. That's cool. So, of course, I come back with another kind of sad story. Triathlete hit and killed while cycling in South Louisiana. This is from My Arc Last Miss. So it's Arkansas, Louisiana and Mississippi.com. Right now, the cycling community in South Louisiana is mourning the loss of one of their own. Two triathletes competing in this weekend's Ironman race were struck by a car while riding their bikes along the Ironman course on Highway 90 near Venetian Isles Friday morning. It's a gut-wrenching image for all cyclists. A race bike cut in half by a car and pieces of what remains scattered in the road. Quote, I ride a lot, and that could have easily been me or somebody that works here, you know, or a customer of ours, said avid cyclist and Bayou Bicycles employee Zachary Thomas. Thomas rides Highway 90 often and says it's a popular training route for all the local cyclists, but Friday, the normally safe, sparsely traveled road was the scene of a deadly crash. In my experience, Chef Highway, I guess is what it's called, CHEF, is usually a pretty safe place to ride, said Thomas. People are pretty aware of the riders out there. New Orleans police say the driver of the car struck two cyclists from behind, killing Frank Gwynn, 36, a veteran firefighter from Atlanta, and critically injuring his 40-year-old brother-in-law. Both triathletes were preparing for Sunday's Ironman 70.3 race. Our hearts go out to the family and friends of the victims, said Executive Director Naomi Dorr of the bike advocacy group Bike Easy. It's very tragic. Barry Edwards, a longtime Ironman triathlete and triathlon coach here in New Orleans, will be among the hundreds competing in this weekend's race. Edwards says he was at the Ironman Expo when he heard there had been an accident. We started calling our local triathlon team, making sure everyone was accounted for, said Edwards. He says the tragedy sent shockwaves through the close-knit group of athletes. It really was just a sad moment, and it really hit home because we are out there every week, said Edwards. So, unfortunately, investigators are still trying to figure out what led to the crash. Police say no charges have been filed against the driver at this time. It's pretty sad. Pretty, pretty sad. All right, move on. Give me something that isn't so sad.
Something that's not so sad, but actually it's something that may help in situations like this in the future.
Okay.
UCI, Brian Cookson said he's mulling over the idea of featuring bike cams for the tour and for other professional races like that.
To what end?
Well, the idea is really what they're trying to do is to market the sport better, to add more up close and personal. Although every time you watch a race, the cameras that are on the motorcycles or all the other things are, they do get really up close and personal. But this is actually just one of those innovations that really they're just trying to get up close and personal and share the sport more with people. And the idea with this also is that if you've got bike cams on in a case where a rider gets hit or they have an incident, that may offer some help.
It's like instant replay.
Right, exactly. Now, what's also interesting is several weeks ago we saw an article that for some mountain biking and some cross biking, what they want to do is they want to take the bike cams off of some of the bikes here in the United States.
Yeah, that's right.
Which they're looking at it, I think, in a different aspect. They're going to let you use it for practice and for qualifying, but during the race, no. And I'm not sure
what the thinking
yeah,
is.
Yeah, I think Who more knows? Camera is better. But so
interesting. So did you find a video of the week?
No, I didn't.
I did.
Okay.
Okay, you ready?
Yep.
Lance Armstrong, you know, needs a job.
Yes.
Okay, so I think he got one. You can watch Lance Armstrong teach you how to change a flat tire at OutsideOnline.com.
Mm-hmm.
It is how to fix a flat with LanceArmstrong.html. I mean, really? Brian looked at it and said he thought it was tongue-in-cheek. I looked at it and said, do not do this at home. Don't follow. I mean, some of it is what we expect when you change a tire, but he's not really teaching. It's pretty funny. There he is in an apron and a little cycling cap in somebody's shop, and he's got a wheel in his hand. He calls the wheel a tire. I thought that was interesting that he didn't even pull up. Now, undo the quick release and take the tire off the bike. No, you take the wheel off the bike and take the tire off the wheel. But anyway, it's pretty funny. It's about, I think it was 2 or 3 minutes. It was kind of good.
Sometimes when you see that, you say, yeah, obviously you don't know anything about what you ride. You just get on it. You're just the athlete. That's
hey,
all.
I understand.
You know.
I understand.
Actually, I think we had a video several months ago with one of the people that we interviewed on the show who changed a bike tire.
Without his hands.
Without his hands.
That is true.
That's so much more worth watching.
This is just worth watching for the...
Because of who it is, yes.
Well, just for the, you know, the yuck level,
yeah,
you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, factor. Go ahead. What you got?
Anybody that's interested in... seeing Richard Schwinn speak on bicycle fabrication. He's going to talk at the Bike Club of Lake County in Illinois on April 22nd.
Oh, cool.
So our friend Richard, when we interviewed him on here, obviously, is a great interview, and he has so much knowledge and history of everything.
His presentations are wonderful. He is just so much more. I mean, he is bigger than life anyway. He's way bigger in life in when you see him in person giving one of these presentations. He's very, very good. And if you have an old Schwinn Paramount and you show up at this, he will be able to tell you something about it because he has all the provenance on all these old Schwinn Paramounts. So that's right. Kind of cool. So I hate to give you yet another one. Jameis Ryder Pinkham dies, apparent accidental overdose. By Brian Holcomb, this was for VeloNews competitor. So Chase Pinkham, who was a former rider for Jameis Hagens Berman and the Trek Livestrong development team, died Sunday night. A friend of the Pinkham family has confirmed to VeloNews. The 23-year-old American rider died of an apparent accidental overdose, according to his family, after years of chronic pain related to a 2008 crash. Pinkham was a rapidly rising prospect in Utah cycling when he was struck by a car while training in Canada prior to the Tour de l'Abitibi stage race in 2008. Following his recovery from the crash, which resulted in facial injuries requiring multiple reconstructive surgeries, Pinkham attracted the attention of the Trek director, Axel Merckx, and joined the development program for the 2010 season. And for those who don't know, Axel Merckx is Eddie Merckx's son. From Trek, Pinkham continued on to domestic teams Bissell and Jameis, for whom he rode in 2013. A story about Pinkham's 2008 accident and subsequent challenges ran in the Deseret News in 2010. According to a March 9th Facebook post, Pinkham dealt with chronic pain and depression related to his 2008 crash. Just wanted to give you an update. If you've tried to get a hold of me the last few days by cell phone, I am currently seeking treatment for some severe depression caused by years of dealing with chronic pain from my accident in 2008. I'm in a safe and good place, but I do not have access to a cell phone. If you need to get a hold of me, please message me here, wrote Pinkham. Dealing with chronic pain, years of medication and depression is something that make you completely alone and hopeless, and even when surrounded by the people who love you. Please remember that if you are suffering currently or ever end up suffering, that you are not alone and that people do love you. There is help available, and asking for it only proves that you have the strength to reach out and the desire to change the state you are in. Many suffer, but so few ask for help that so many people are willing to give. According to his close friend, Alex Kim, or the family's close friend, Chase underwent dozens of surgeries related to the crash, suffered from chronic pain. He was eliminating his use of narcotic painkillers, according to Kim, earlier this year when he suffered a broken leg at the Valley of the Sun stage race in Arizona. Following the crash, doctors again prescribed narcotic painkillers. He was house-sitting last weekend in Salt Lake City when friends discovered his body. He did not take his own life. So that is very, very sad. An outpouring of grief followed the news of Pinkham's death, with former teammates among those offering condolences. You know what? I'm done with stories for the week, but do you have one more?
Well, let's do one more.
On an up note?
That's not sad. We got an email from our friend Liz Jose over at WeBike in New York. She's accepted a job in Seattle, Washington, doing youth development with Bike Works. This is no change in any way, shape, or form for WeBike New York. The programming won't change, the mission, the goal, the logos, everything remain the same, and it will remain in New York City. She is going to continue on with the consulting role with the group, and she'll maintain her email if you communicate with her. But all inquiries should go to Casey Ashenhurst. Casey will take over the role of what Liz did and everything else.
At WeBike New York.
At WeBike. At BikeWorks in Seattle, she's going to start her new position on June 1st, and she's going to do everything that she did over there at WeBike to just continue to grow the bike community and development for programs over there in Seattle.
Well, from New York to Seattle, talk about from one end of the spectrum to the other. But that's great. I'm glad she's moving into a new position. I hope she likes it out in Seattle. We need to scurry on over to Greensboro, Alabama, to talk with Pam Doerr. I think you're going to find this lady really interesting. Pam, thanks for joining me on the Outspoken Cyclist this evening.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Yes, it's my pleasure. So I was looking for some new ideas about the North American Handmade Bicycle Show and saw the headline about a stolen bike that led me on a journey to you. And you sound like one of the most fascinating people I have ever read about, and I'm excited to be able to talk with you.
Oh, thanks for that.
You've created an actual transformation in a little tiny town called Greensboro, Alabama. We'll talk about your bicycle connection, but I'm almost more excited about just what you're doing down there from the entrepreneurial aspect. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to Greensboro, Alabama.
Well, I ended up coming down here because there's a special architecture program that's based in Greensboro. It's called the Auburn University Rural Studio.
Hmm.
And it's and I came from San Francisco to study with them and then just never went home.
And that was back in 2003.
Yeah, that's right.
Weren't you with Victoria's Secret?
I was. I had designed product for them for, well, I guess I was in the apparel industry about 20 years.
What did you find so compelling about Greensboro, Alabama? From everything I've read at the time you were there, it was a pretty poor, almost, you know, dilapidated place.
You know, I think it's funny moving here from San Francisco. What I realized is there's a lot of opportunity. It's one of the kind of the walkable downtowns where I live downtown. I can walk to the grocery store. I can walk to work. My dad lives downtown now, and it's just one of those towns where there's a lot of front porches and really kind people. It's a wonderful place to live.
Give us a sense of the size of the area.
The town of Greensboro is about 1,700 people, county has about 17,500.
Tell me some of the projects you've initiated, and then we're gonna kind of talk about each one. We'll get to your bicycle project and then move on to what actually connects this to our show. I'm more interested, though, in everything else. It's so cool.
Well, I like that you're interested. So we started out just kind of helping with social services through our nonprofit. Then we started building affordable housing, became a housing resource center where we became HUD housing counselors so we could help people with things like buying a home, renting a home, repairing a home, just to kind of improve the level of substandard housing, but also provide energy-efficient, cost-effective housing.
Okay. And then?
Then we realized we maybe could do some work around creating jobs and job training. We started working with out-of-school youth to help them earn their GEDs and get some job training. And then through a lot of different connections, and I'd like to think that all of this happened because I'm so terrific. That isn't the situation. It kind of happened because this is an amazing community of really engaged people, and that it's a really youthful community. There's a lot of other organizations that are working here to create change. There's Project Horseshoe Farm and Teach for America, Habitat for Humanity. Everybody kind of works together to kind of create change. So and we have some terrific partners with universities and some marketing designers that just are incredible people. So all of that together makes it work. It's not because I'm so terrific.
Well,
you've
done some pretty amazing things, though. So tell us a little bit about your nonprofit, and then we're going to back into a couple of the businesses eventually coming to Hero Bikes.
Okay, yeah. Our nonprofit was started in 1994, and a lot of the original members of the board are still on the board. And really, we all just work together to kind of create a more vibrant community.
The name of that is Hero?
Well, Hero is an acronym. It's HALE, which is our county, HALE Empowerment and Revitalization Organization. So the idea when it was started was really to create some revitalization, and that's what's happening downtown.
Yeah, it actually sounds like an interesting place. Let's talk about pies.
Okay.
Even though this is Passover and we're not supposed to eat pie, tell me about pie anyway.
I love pie. So I think a couple different things happened to help us start a pie shop here downtown, and the most important one was that a group of really creative graphic designers and other product designers got together up in Maine, and they were kind of talking about what wasn't working in the economy. You know, they were having a tough time getting jobs, and everything was really a downer, and then they started talking about what they were passionate about, and one of the girls in that group was really passionate about pie, and she started talking about how she liked pie, and it kind of got infectious with the rest of the group, and the group was Project M, led by John Bielenberg, and they had all come together to kind of do a project, and what they ended up doing for their project was baking a lot of pies and creating this by giving out pie on real plates. It was a way for people to linger over pie and really start to have a conversation, and they called me at the end of that weekend, and they were saying, we've put together $600, and we want to start a pop-up pie shop in your town. And I went, it was just so exciting for me. I love pie. When my niece got married, she didn't want a wedding cake. She wanted my peach crumb pie.
Yeah, why not? Sounds good. Peach crumb pie. So that has grown into a sustainable business. How many employees?
There's a lot of employees at Pie. I'm not sure how many there are now, but it's really grown. And right now we're selling pies at the local farmer's market up in Birmingham, and can sell 100 pies in a day at a farmer's market. It's pretty exciting. So there's a lot of baking to do.
Yeah, I guess. One of the things that surprised me is that bamboo grows wild, and everybody thinks it's a nuisance, except you saw an opportunity.
Well, I'd like to think it was me that came up with a bright idea, but it was actually a combination of things. We had some really creative young designers that were spending a year with us, and they loved bikes and started working with salvage bikes. And, you know, eventually that project got pretty big, rebuilding salvage bikes, and the local shop class at the high school took that over. And we still had this passion for bikes, and we had a lot of bamboo, and a really interesting man at the Bamboo Bike Studio in Brooklyn. We called him up, and he was a friend of John Bielenberg from Project M, and we started talking to him about what might be possible here. Eventually, he came down. He checked out our bamboo. We started shipping him bamboo to supply the products he was making, and then eventually, he taught us how to make bamboo bikes, and eventually, he wanted to move on to take over his family's fishing business in Portland, Maine, and we ended up buying out part of his business.
Aha. Uh-huh. So your bikes have an interesting shape. How did you come up with a hexagonally shaped tube?
It's even hard to say.
Yes, it is. Hexagonally shaped tube. I got it.
So it started in kind of a funny way. We have a great partner at the University of Kansas. He's an industrial designer named Lance Rake. He got really passionate about the bamboo here and took a sabbatical. He and his wife went to India to study bamboo at the Bamboo Institute and then came back with some really unusual ideas on how to manufacture a carbon fiber bamboo composite tube. And one of them is a hex tube, and there's a newer tube we're working on as well. But we developed some provisional patents using that technology, and then eventually developed the Semester Bike, which is a bike that went to the bike show up in Charlotte that you heard about.
I'm speaking with Pamela Doerr. She is, I don't know, she's a lady of many, 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 many hats. Give yourself a title. Who are you? If somebody said, "Hi, I'm Pam Doerr," I
I do it all.
I do it all. Yeah, that's exactly what we women do. We do it all.
We do it all.
So,
we do what it takes to get the job done.
That is so true. Tell us the story of the stolen bike at NABS, which is how I found out about you to begin with.
I think it's a terrific story.
It is a terrific
story. One of
the
things we started laughing about was if our bike was the first bike ever stolen at a North American hand-built bike show, maybe it was the most desirable bike. We like to think that.
Well, there is that.
So one of the things that happened is, you know, the morning we came into the show and our bike was gone out of our booth, we realized we should start locking our bikes at night. That was one thing. But the second thing, the show promoters were so terrific, they decided to put a little story on their blog about it disappearing. And then it got repeated onto Twitter, and the Charlotte community came together so fast. Instantly, we were getting tweets and messages back that our bike was seen downtown. And eventually, the community got together. They found the guy that had taken the bike, and they got it returned to us. And it was really incredible. I think it's a real story of a really tight biking community and what can happen when people help each other.
It's true. And the North American Handmade Bicycle Show is a very interesting group of builders, craftsmen, artisans, and the consumer who comes in is so passionate about bicycling. So was that the first time you had displayed at a show like that?
It's our second time going to the show. We were out in Denver. It was our first time with this bike, and it was really exciting. And what we were thinking when the guy was caught riding our bike is we probably should get some quotes from him about how much he enjoyed riding it around town.
Before they arrest him and put him in jail.
We also got a few photos from around town. The bike had gone to a few parties with him the night before, and we got photos of our bike at a number of parties. It was pretty exciting to see it had a life outside of us.
I was just going to say, it sounds like it just turned into its own marketing program all by itself. So one of the things I'd like to sort of wrap the conversation around is your nonprofit and what it is that you do in the nonprofit world.
Sure, we do a number of different things, but affordable housing is kind of how we started, and then also helping with housing resources. Then we started developing some small businesses. And in terms of our bike business as a nonprofit, what we're here to do is kind of create jobs and job training while we're making ourselves a sustainable business that can help the community. And we really try and use what we've got to build to do more. And bamboo's our thing.
I understand that now. I don't remember his name, but I did watch the video of that young man who is running your bike program. And he said something about shipping bikes all over the world.
We do. Yeah, we take orders through our website, and we have a couple ways we can help people. They can fly here and build their own bike in a weekend.
Wow.
We can send them a kit with a full jig, and they make their own bike at home. And we ship those to about 11 countries. And then we also have this new semester bike that we're building, and we ship those bikes worldwide right now, which is pretty exciting.
Yes, it is. I'm pretty impressed. And I do have some interest in the bamboo composite combination. But rather than get into a technical conversation, I want to move on and see what's on your plate next. Because I know you probably are never going to stop.
Well, we took kind of a prototype frame to the last bike show, and we're really excited about a woven bias tube composite with carbon fiber. So the frame itself, we think, might be around just under 2 pounds or 900 grams when it's finished. And it's a really high-performance, again, bamboo and carbon fiber composite.
Wow. Wow. I'm excited to see that. Do you have any sort of designs on Interbike, or is that just way out of the scope of what you're thinking?
Well, we enjoyed Interbike last year. We went ahead but we just went and met people, and we met with our suppliers. It was really an interesting show for us. So as we get bigger, we'd like to be able to. But for right now, I think the hand-built show is the one for us.
So do you have something on your plate besides bicycles for
a
project?
We're building some woven bamboo skateboards. Our dream is to have a bamboo stand-up paddleboard. We're also doing some craft necklaces made with Italian yarns, and we employ 13 people in that line of work.
Wow, that's interesting, because I teach yoga, and I've got a woman up in Canandaigua, New York, who's trying to convince me to come up and do stand-up yoga, SUP yoga, on a board. And I'm like, I don't know. I mean, yeah, falling into the water wouldn't be bad as long as it's warm enough. But, you know, stand-up paddle boards. How cool is that? Wow, you are one busy lady. Do you ever have time to have fun?
Oh, you bet. Work in my garden every weekend.
Oh, good for you. I guess you have a good climate down there for that.
It's beautiful. wonderful, yeah.
Well, I'd really like to stay in touch and know more about both the bike work you're doing and some of the other work you're doing. You really are a fascinating woman, and you obviously love what you're doing.
We definitely do. I think this is a town that's pretty passionate about everything that it does. I feel really lucky to be part of it.
Well, I am so glad I had an opportunity to speak with you. I hope you have a wonderful weekend, and we will talk again.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Pam Dore, join me from hero.org. What do you think?
Fascinating. Another interest. I love people that are doing 100 different things at once and doing them all well.
You know, women can do that.
She is what, I don't know if this is the right phrase, but she's truly a Renaissance woman.
Yeah, exactly. That's an interesting phrase. I like
that.
She
does everything.
She does. And she sounds like she loves everything she's doing. That's very, very cool. Well, that is our show for this evening. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Paul Sadoff and with Pamela Dore. We will be back next week with another brand new edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. I hope your weather's good. Hope you get out for a bike ride. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.